that's as big a loss as anybody, including Five, probably in the last several years.
Well, I can't sit idly by and just allow all this Max Garbanot slander to continue. So I'm going to jump in on the mic. Hello and welcome to At the 55, your home for OUA football. Me and Tom are back on the mics here for episode 5 of the exit meeting interview. We are diving into the Waterloo Warriors. You know, Tom, I feel like this is just becoming a staple for these episodes because I want to get to our guests. So how the heck are you doing, my friend?
Well, I'm always doing well, but I'm doing even better now that we have friend of the show on the podcast. We've been wanting to get him on for so long, and now we finally have a Mr. Adam McGuire, ladies and gentlemen. So nice to have you on here, sir.
Always a pleasure to catch up with you guys in my favorite OUA football podcast.
That means the world. That means the world, man. You know, if you don't know the name, shame on you. Of course, the voice of Waterloo football on OUA TV. Correct me, though, or help me out. You also call some hockey in the region, too, right?
Yeah, so men's and women's hockey at Waterloo, right in the thick of those playoff races right now. Fill in once in a while for Kitchener Rangers broadcast, just a couple times here or there when need be. For those friends at Rogers TV. But yeah, it's mostly black and gold all the time for me.
Voice of Warrior Sports across the board and a great follow on Twitter and on X to stay up to date on OUA action. I want to actually start on the broadcasting side of these. And if you don't have a side of things, and if you don't have an answer right now, we can table it for later on in the discussion. But I figured once we get into the football stuff, we're just going to get rolling. So I wanted to get this off the jump because you've been calling games, you know, going back to seeing a certain guy wearing number 5, slinging the rock out there. And of course, all the electric players that were on those teams. What is your favorite call or sort of moment in broadcasting Waterloo Warriors football? I would assume number 5, of course, Trey Ford would have something to do with that. But maybe it's something I'm not thinking of. And like I said, if you want to say, let's come back to that towards the end, happy to do that as well.
No, it's, I think I can answer it. Although like 4 different moments popped to mind, but honestly, it's a loss. If you want to believe it, it was the 2019 Battle of Waterloo. 3 overtimes and Thursday night.
Aguavon, right? Was that the
Aguavon was great in that game. Trying to remember. I can't remember in the overtime who scored the final touchdown for Laurier. It was a 53-50 game, triple overtime. I called with our friend Jack Moore. It was the Thursday night under the lights of the Thanksgiving weekend. It was the only game of the night. Probably the biggest audience we had. I was a corpse after that game. And if you want to talk moments specifically, there was a time in that game. So Waterloo went down in that game or early in the first half. They stormed back in the second half. The game was tied 30-30, I think. And Waterloo got the ball. They made a third down stop right around midfield on their side of midfield. And the first play that Chris Bertoia calls was a hook and lateral where Gordon Lamb pivoted in on the hook and Tyler Ternowski on a cross took the lateral, took it all the way down to field goal range, and the field goal was blocked. I think it was Sam Achampong that got a paw.
Of course it was.
And blocked that field goal, blocked the 41-ish yard field goal that would have won it for the Warriors, and they fell in triple overtime. So wild stuff. Trey Ford was electric in that game. I think he had 3 rushing touchdowns and 3 passing touchdowns. I guess that would be number 1 for me. Close second would
be tough
to beat that. The close second, I know, rambling on here now. First game that Trey took over as a full-time starter. His first game in this second season of 2018, 6 passing touchdowns and 1 rushing touchdown against Windsor. Electric stuff. Always electric stuff with number 5.
Oh, gosh, I do miss the days of seeing Trey Ford on the field regularly. Hopefully we'll get to see him in the Edmonton Elks uniform once again. However, they are bringing in a couple of quarterbacks. It's making me a little nervous.
Or another uniform, maybe. I don't know.
Get him in another uniform. Whoever's going to properly use
him. Get him on the field, guy is right? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Sticking on the broadcasting side of things, because like Zach said, as soon as we get into the actual game on the field, we won't stop. We've been talking a lot about the streams of the OUA, OUA TV in general, how things are going. Some schools elected to partner up with some of the local stations like Rogers TV with Guelph. Other schools may not have that capability or not that partnership. In your opinion, how important is the quality of the broadcast to the game itself in terms of growing the game and just getting people excited about the game in general?
Yeah, it's a huge piece. And, you know, I'm really sympathetic to schools that maybe don't have some of the higher quality setups or the more technically advanced setups. And we're one of them at Waterloo. And it's just a matter of personnel and know-how and equipment. You know, on the hockey side, I can say, you know, TMU has outstanding broadcasts because they have a sports media program. So of course they do. Mm-hmm. They have the equipment that the, you know, that the program, the faculty has purchased itself, right? So it's really hard for me. Like, you know, the people at Waterloo, I can say they, like, we get every ounce and then some out of the people that work there. They work tirelessly. Like our sports information department and part-time game day staff and everybody is just the best. But it is a really, you know, it is really nice to see the really high quality broadcasts with replays, and you know there's a truck working that's got production in it. And I think it's really like a huge part. Now, how do you pay for it? I don't know, because Canada West certainly has great broadcast quality, but their exposure is limited to who wants to pony up the money to pay for a Canada West subscription. So mm-hmm. I don't really have the economics answer there, other than to say I think it would go a long way. If there was investment from, you know, a league level or a U Sports level, even, or an OUA level, to, you know, kind of even the playing field. And if you have a relationship with a journalism school or you don't really notice the difference.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel like we're probably going to have to expand this into a larger conversation and get some of your brethren behind the mics in the broadcast booth on this, because there are so many great angles we can approach it. And I think why this is such an important conversation is because, as we all know, the product on the field is top notch. And I think when it doesn't match up, that's frustrating. And then just generally from that perspective of, once again, resources being whatever they may, the effort you're putting in on that side, it's kind of a reflection, or feels like it's sometimes a reflection of a level of care. It's not always that simple. And I don't mean to paint with a broad brush, but sometimes it does give that approach. But that quality on the field, like I said, is something else. And I can't hold back diving in with your squad right now, because we just finished talking about the Guelph Griffins, Tom and I, just a day ago. Obviously, by the time these recordings are coming out, all of this kind of preamble is meaningless. But talking about Guelph, the team that just nearly missed out on the playoffs as a result of your Waterloo Warriors sneaking in, them both ending up 3-5. Waterloo having beat Guelph, being a big part of that tiebreak scenario there. And that game is just one of the many games. When I go through this Waterloo schedule, much like Tom and I talked about with Guelph, and there really are some great similarities between these clubs this past year, and it starts with the schedules. They're very interesting. So just to run through it quickly, it starts with that loss in Ottawa, an incredibly competitive game. Nolan Caban's back at quarterback. He's doing what he did last year, slinging it out with somewhat reckless abandon because it leads to 4 turnovers. They go into that York game. They go to Nick Orr at quarterback. And I remember the commentary for me and Tom is, this is tough because either one of those quarterbacks is going to have a great outing against York, you'd presume. So if you make the switch, Orr is kind of getting that added jump of coming off of the, you get that, right? But then even then, bit of a tumultuous game with York. That Windsor game, that once again, thank you so much for the invitation to call it with you in the booth from Waterloo. 37-0. We were there, and we were saying all game long, bias aside, an incredibly competitive game. Laurier, we knew this year they weren't in the same league. Laurier did that to nearly every team that was not on a level with them, and to some teams that were close to it. That Guelph win, huge. Guelph battling a bit of quarterback injuries at the time, but still, Waterloo, Guelph, I know firsthand from talking to some players, Bertoia has a lot of feelings about those Guelph Griffins, so I know that's a meaningful win for those guys. And then just to run through the ending, though, that loss to Mac when they're seemingly out of sorts, that loss to Carleton, which I don't know if it's a better comeback or the bigger upset, whichever that is, and then you take care of business at U of T, but they made that interesting as well. all to say, and we can dive into all these games in detail, such a fascinating schedule in a year where that could have been a 5-3 finish just as easily as it was 3-5.
Yeah, you know, like, it's funny. Like, they were definitely a lot of coin flip games. Probably from the eye test, like, 3-5 is probably right. 4-4 is, you know, I guess if you look at the Carlton game, for instance, that's the woulda, shoulda, coulda game, I think. Mm-hmm. And sometimes these games come down to one play. Like, that Carlton game, you know, like, Cole Waddell is a long snapper. He doesn't make any highlights. Obviously, he's a long snapper. He goes out in that Mac game, and then Waterloo's got a backup long snapper. Everything's a little slower on specialty teams. And in that Carlton comeback, there's a block punt for a touchdown that they turn into seven right away. Right? Yeah. So these little tiny plays and injuries, your long snapper, like, who'd have thunk it? But yeah, I think to answer your question, like, probably right where the Warriors should be and should have been in the end of the season, right? Growing from that big time turnover. It wasn't just Trey and Tyrell, by the way. That senior day in 2021, I think we had 32 players walk on their senior day parade before that game, just with the COVID year and how the, you know, the first big BERT recruiting class kind of. So 1-7 to 3-5, I think it all makes sense, right? And there's a lot of youth and a lot of, you know, pieces. These things are always, you know, the way that timing aligns is always funny, right? You think if Waterloo had the pass rush they had this year, if those pass rushers were 18 to 24 months older, they probably make a Yates Cup, at least one Yates Cup final from 2018 to 2021, right? Just sometimes the way things go and the way the birth certificates line up. So, yeah, I mean, I think all in all, a season that the Warriors would be happy with. They know they left some things out there. Even in that Ottawa game, right? It was 16-10 and the Warriors had possession at midfield in the fourth quarter. But the turnovers, kind of bit them there. In the Guelph game, it could have gone the other way, right? And almost did. There was a turnover. Guelph had the ball at midfield and James Hinsberger forced a turnover on Marshall McRae, who'd come into that game and had lit up the Warriors in the fourth quarter. And that led to, you know, Cole Crossett's game-winning field goal. So, I mean, all told, I think successful season, but a successful kind of building block and not a lot of satisfaction, but probably right where they should be.
Mm-hmm. When you look at some of the talent that has come through this Waterloo Warrior program, obviously you think of the Ford brothers, you think of the offense in particular here, but when you see a guy like a Tyson Hergott, who can on his own seemingly take over games in terms of pressuring quarterbacks, disrupting in the backfield, and just kind of being that overall game changer. I know we'll dive into a little bit more of the personnel details, but just while we're talking about these real big stars for this Waterloo Warrior program, how big is it losing him going into this year?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, the best down lineman in the province, probably the next best, the second best in the country, best on the defensive side of the ball. I think there's not a lot of argument. Statistically, like, stuff that jumps off the page, right? Like Matthew Betts level stuff, really, from Hergott and his ability to stop the run. I did a big deep dive into the kind of the game logs, and I think I found, you know, in addition to the sack totals, you know, 11 sacks, I think there were, I want to say 17 or 18 solo tackles on runs of 3 yards or less. So when you add that to 14 tackles for loss, 11 of which were sacks, that's not a lot of progress if nine gets his hands on you. And it's going to be a huge loss. Like he's the most impactful player at that position that I've seen in 10 years of doing this. At Waterloo and trying to put my biases aside and rack my brain, but probably anywhere in the OUA, at least, as dominant as any of the you know, premier defensive ends have been. So yeah, it's going to be a huge loss and it'll just be, for the Warriors trying to find not only replacements for him, but, you know, Trevon Halstead on that line who didn't have the numbers. It was really hard to double Tyson Hergott on a regular basis because Caden Jajal and Halstead and others could get pressure. They could bring pressure from the linebacking core too. So it's all the cascading, effect of losing Hurgadt and Halstead.
Mm-hmm. Just before you jump into things, Zach, it's the first time in my recent memory where you and I, Zach and I, were kind of going back and forth as the season was going here, saying, if Kalani Amusin breaks the OUA sack record, there's a very real possibility here that the OUA looks at this and goes, Tyson Hurgadt has the numbers to be a defensive overall MVP. And I think still should have been that, and give Kalani the nod at the defensive lineman, because you see, not only is it the tackles for loss, not only is it the sacks, he had a couple of pass breakups. I think he had an interception in there as well. Like, he was all over the field. Whenever number nine is on that defense, it's just a game changer. So we were so high on him that we were like, well, he's got the D-line locked up. Is he maybe the defensive overall MVP?
Yeah, it was an incredible season. He did have an interception in that Ottawa game, four strip sacks, by four consecutive games with a strip sack fumble that was lost by the opponent, by the way, all the first four games of the season. Just an outrageous performance. The Guelph game, he nearly single-handedly kept the Griffins at bay for the Warriors to find those last 3 points on the Cole Cressette winning field goal. So, that's as big of a loss to me. That's as big a loss as anybody, including five, probably in the last several years.
Well, I can't sit idly by and just allow all this Max Garbineau slander to continue. So I'm going to jump in on the mic. No, I obviously love Tyson Hurgadt, and I love how you led the parade around midseason of being like, once again, why you got to follow Mr. McGuire online. Just starting that parade, the Pied Piper of, you guys, Tyson Hurgadt's really good at football, in case you aren't paying attention. League, top, Metris. I can't remember if you were ringing the bell for DPOI altogether, but just, you were the first voice vocalizing that. But as you say, it's not just him. You mentioned just on the defensive line, but as well, you've seen, friend of the program and one of the better kickers in the province, Cole Crossette, is a graduate student who I imagine will be done after this one. Jack Andrews as well, Justin Sukar, seeing Steven Schwartz on that offensive line and that run game, certainly something that I want to get into. A couple other names I was looking at here, James Pazaliga obviously being huge. Once again, seemingly always having all these weapons at wide out, no matter who's at quarterback. How do you contrast where this team's at, where you do have a really young core and a lot of talented young players? Quentin Springer, talking about that running game, can't wait to dive into what a season he had, with a lot of this aging talent and sort of from that standpoint of where the team's at on looking at kind of the culture, who the leaders are, with a lot of these veteran players moving on from the program. Some of them have eligibility, so like as me and Tom talked about with Guelph, hard to say for certain. But just reconciling that with like a lot of this veteran talent aging out possibly, and a lot of the core players right now being in that younger class.
Yeah, I think it's the problem that every program that's not Western has, frankly. Like, this is the thing. You get 5 years, and you guys have talked about it before. It's complicated. More so now because of the COVID year. Tyson Hurgadt's a great example. He walked on our senior day at Waterloo, but he's really had two full seasons because he lost a year of COVID. He lost a year to an injury. It's really interesting, right? So certainly the possibility exists for some of those players to return with eligibility left. And I think you guys know what, as well as I do, sometimes they're just not ready to give up football. It's three courses to be a full-time course load. It's like, I can do this for the fall term. I can enroll. I can play. I can pass three classes and keep my academic standing good, even if I've got kind of the requirements for a diploma or degree or not. But yeah, I think at this point, there's a few guys that I think will be those new leaders, right? So you mentioned on the offense, it's going to be really tough because not only Schwartz, but Ethan Calra is gone from that offensive line, both starting slot backs, Sukar and Pazaliga. But at the same time, you've got Anthony Miller, who is a veteran now. Springer's in his second year. I really look on the defensive side, you know, a guy like James Hinsberger. Really under the radar, excellent season for the Warriors, also coming back from a long, you know, injury. We know what the pedigree of the name carries at Waterloo. He's the third Hinsberger brother. I'm sure he'll be a huge cog in the defense. So those will be the guys, as well as obviously Orr. And from everything that I've heard, Nolan Caban too. Like, Nolan Caban and Nick Orr get along great. Caban is nothing but supportive. He's a smart guy. He knows, he can see things on the sideline really well. He's kind of a cerebral quarterback. And I think those are the guys that'll kind of be counted on. And then if people come back that have eligibility left that we don't know about, that's kind of the bonus, right? You know, we all expect Tyson Herregaard will be drafted somewhere at some point, but we've seen players of really high caliber, even at that position, get sent back. I think it was, I want to say it was Malcolm Campbell from U of T. Is that right?
Yep.
Two or three years ago, he was drafted, I want to say in the third or fourth round, came back, you know, was drafted, had a good camp, but they sent him back. Like, that happens at this level sometimes. So I guess those are the things that, that are the variables that I guess you could hope for if you're Waterloo, but, if not, you've got a core that you kind of have to rely on, with some of those guys like, you know, Hinsberger and Keyshawn Bowen as well in the linebacking core, I think will be a huge part.
Yeah. We can't properly talk about how important it is or the influence that certain players will have without talking about the defensive coordinator that has just left. Coach DA gets the head coaching job at the U of T Blues, and we are all so excited for him. I think that's been a long time coming. Even myself having a limited interaction with him on some all-star games, actually, he and I got a chance to coach together many years ago. The atmosphere that he brings to the team, the positivity that he has, he's just an overall influential presence within the locker room, I'm sure. What does that mean to lose a guy like Coach DA, despite the fact that you still have Coach Bertoia, and there's not many guys, in my opinion, who is as positive as that man is, but DA leaving the program, going to U of T, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, like, Coach DA is, I've said before too, every time I talk to Coach DA, I learn something, maybe about football, maybe not. Just super smart, understood his role, you know, on the field as well as off the field. And I think it'll be a great hire for U of T. I think it's a pretty unanimous sentiment that that's going to be the case. And yeah, it's a hole for sure. I think on the flip side of that, though, is that this is what successful programs do, right? And I've been around in various facets of covering, you know, going way back to when I was a student several 20 years ago, writing for the student newspaper and covering Warriors teams. You know, I started doing this in 2012. I did a few color games. I've been play-by-play full-time for them, for the football team, since 2014. This is not something that happened at Waterloo. You didn't have coaches that were in demand by any other programs. And it does a little bit remind me of kind of what it felt like, or kind of what I think it probably felt like, I wasn't there, when Bert left Western, right? It was time. He had the frank conversations, you know, with Coach Greg Marshall, and, you know, Greg says, yeah, I think you're ready. Like, Greg Marshall played a really big role in Bert's hiring at Waterloo. It feels like it's the same kind of thing here. I know DA is super well-respected. He was at the end-of-season banquet just last week. They were able to present him with a legacy award that they present to some of the graduating students as well. And he leaves a big impact, but a big hole for sure. So yeah, it's in addition to the defensive, you know, game calling scheme X's and O's things, it's recruiting and it's, environment and it's like, everything on and off the field that I think there'll be a hole to fill. But I think the program's itself has kind of taken on that personality of Burton DA. So I imagine whoever that successful candidate is will kind of mirror that personality too.
Well, and that personality, as you described it with both of them, it really are individuals who value that relationship piece first and foremost. And as Tom knows a little better than I do, as a more sought after recruit, if we're going to play the Wayback Machine game, that relationship piece is something so formative of a place you're not just going to play football, but call your home. From that standpoint, and you know, because I wanted to talk to you about Coach Bertoy a bit, because I mean, he's one of my favorite coaches, just people in the OUA. That team, that school, in regards to the football program, is one of my favorite as far as just the game day experience, the way everything's organized, the way the community really does seem to get into it. The field house being this amazing new addition. We can talk about where the team is at on the field year in, year out, coming off the Trey Ford era. And I certainly want to ask as well, to the extent that Trey's time played into just sort of this general, the general zeitgeist, if you will, of Waterloo football, because though I also think the team is in a position where maybe it's not next year, but maybe the year after, they're right back there again contending. But just as far as that upward trajectory the program has been in and has continued to be in, that I think has so much to do with, yes, Trey Ford, but with what Coach Bertoia has been doing for the past, what is it now? It's 10 years,
I guess. Yeah, season nine. 2015 was his first year, I think. I think you and your Griffins
have christened his career
into the OUA as a head coach.
But yeah, I'm not mistaken in connecting the dots with what I feel is immense positivity at the program. Of course, coming off, going back almost two decades, such a fallow period with the scandal that happened there, but connecting a lot of that positive energy and progression to what Chris Bertoia has done there, right?
Yeah, 100%. And that's why, you know, actually, I think 3-5, when I say it was a successful season, obviously it's a bit of a hard sell when it's a game of wins and losses. I get it. And Bert would be the first one to say that that's not, they don't set out to have a 3-5 season. But it was a big deal, I think, for Bert and the program to show that they weren't an anomaly with the Fords, right? If you just look at the data, the 2 years before the Fords arrived, 2015 and 16, Bert's record was 0-16 as a head coach, right? And then the first year that they leave, Bert's record is 1-7, and the only win is at York. So there was a bit of a message that needed to be sent, I think. And I don't think Bert would ever say this or let on that this was the case, but I'm sure that it feels good for Bert and the staff and the entire administration, who, in fairness, really has invested a lot in the football program. That, you know, the talk shortly after, even after the team came back from the suspension in 2010, the talk very much, you know, was, do we continue with this program? You know, it wasn't until it wasn't that long ago, 2008 or 9, I think, was the first time they had their own stadium. Like, when I was a student there, we played at University Stadium, and there was a Hawk at midfield in our home games at Waterloo. Like, so all of that to say, I guess, is for Bert to kind of show, and for the program to kind of show, like, yeah, we are a sustainable model here that's more than recruiting, you know, two twins that were once in a lifetime talents. We can do this. We can build this, right? And I think we've seen it, you know, over and over again. The thing that Bert has talked about was it's about building depth, right? It's about when guys graduate out, you don't have, you know, 19 teenagers starting in your dress roster of 47, right? Or 24, 28, 30, not to bemoan any current programs, but we've seen this recently too, right? Where you've got, you know, essentially a, you know, teenagers playing against third and fourth and fifth year players, and that was always the goal. Bert has talked about that, you know, building the depth, and we're going to see it this year. The guys I just mentioned carrying the torch that are coming up are all, you know, second, third, fourth year guys. There's not going to be, there's less for Bert. There's probably less to sell as far as playing time. That was always the thing, right? And you guys talked about it with Dakota on your on your York pod. That was a big selling point. Playing time, do you want to sit? It's like, maybe actually for a year so I don't get killed. Like, that might not be a bad idea. So I can learn the ropes and I can get into the weight room and I can, learn the systems and learn the playbook. So that to me, I think, is a huge piece of this program now. And for a long time, it was kind of a Trey Ford was the face of the program. And I think, I think they're building towards kind of the Western model where Coach Marshall's the face of that program. I think that's the goal here. And I think Bert's on his way.
Most definitely. I have nothing but massive respect for Coach Bertoia back in my day, which seems it gets longer and longer every time I say that. It's getting a little scary here. But when I was getting recruited myself, the big reason I was really considering Western was because of Coach Bertoia at the time. He's the offensive line coach, and the way that he talked to people, the way that he handled himself was really outstanding. And even to the point where I was out in Waterloo, just saw visiting some friends, went into a restaurant, happened to see him and Coach Robichaud talking to a potential recruit. And I stepped in and said, "Hey, I go to a different university. You would be fantastic to go with these guys." And I had no problem saying that because of the quality of character that not only Coach Bertoia has, but he holds amongst his staff as well. So nothing but respect for that man. Switching gears, we talked about the defensive coordinator, talked about the head coach. Want to go into the offensive coordinator. So obviously for the past little while previously, John B, he was there during that Trey Ford era. He brings that air raid kind of offense that he had at Mac when I was there to Waterloo, and you obviously see such great success. Obviously, Trey Ford, Tyler Tanowski, and all of the guys you have on the field is a big part of that. But I think the play calling that he had and the way that he was able to work with the guys also is a big factor. He leaves in 22, and you have a kind of co-offensive coordinator situation, and then Brandon Conway completely takes over this year. And we really see, especially in the run game, some great success with the players that you have and a real commitment to the power run game in particular here. While the offense in the air might have struggled a little bit with Nolan Caban and Nick Orr trying to find their groove a little bit, the run game was really where that kind of came in. Is there any real big differences that you've seen from Coach Conway, from Coach Behe into Coach Conway and the way that they're calling the games and the way that they're utilizing the athletes around them?
Yeah, not really. So I will say, like, when Coach Behe was at Waterloo, it was definitely kind of a two-hander with Coach Behe and Bert. And, with Coach Conway, this was actually a design succession plan over 2 years. He and Bert were going to have the title of co-offensive coordinator for a year. That was 22, where Coach Conway, who, by the way, was a linebacker and a special teams coach and linebackers coach after he graduated, and is one of the hardest working coaches you'll see anywhere. He this was part of the plan. So kind of learned the ropes for the entire year with Bert and then was given those reins this year. As far as like any differences, though, I think it was actually just driven by circumstance of personnel at this point. At one point, I remember talking to Bert kind of midway through the year. And, you know, Bert is a big balance guy with his offense. And he'll say this constantly, like, I think the best teams have to be able to run the ball in the toughest times. But you can't rely on this. This is what we did at Western. This is how Western, this is why Western's 8-0 or 7-1 every year. They can kind of get you both ways. And when it gets cold and windy, like he's always said, we play our playoff games in October, November, you're going to have to run the ball. But very much a believer in balance in the 50-50. But over the course of, several games or a season, not necessarily, or even multiple seasons, but not necessarily in one season. So I think what we saw this year is midway through the year, Bert said, we have kind of just simplified things. We want to get good at simple football. And we're doing very little install from week to week. And that's probably, Tom, where a lot of the power run game stuff came in. Let's have simple concepts and do it better than anybody else. And that will be how we gain our yards. Because look, we were dealing, we you know, this was a second year quarterback and a first year starter. You know, it was still a very young offensive line. The Warriors returned 4 of 5 offensive linemen last year. They'll return 3 of 5 this year. You know, in 22, they started 2 rookies all year in the offensive line because they graduated some of those great, you know, the Curtis twins and Greg Brand and, you know, Spencer Andrews and all of those guys had graduated out of the program. And so, yeah, I think it was just a matter of what we have now and how we want to bring this along is to do things simply and move the ball simply. So I think that'll probably, we'll see probably changes of that this year too, just based on the personnel, right? And it may still be focused on the run because the two, you know, biggest targets, the slot backs of Sukar and Vasiliga are gone. Like I was checking the stats today. Evan Vasiliga had 16 catches. That's the most among any returning receiver for the Warriors. So they're going to need some people to step up to catch the ball. But I guess we'll see, right? It'll be Coach Conway's second year calling the offense. And I suspect they'll probably try to find some more balance. And if they can't, they'll try to do the same thing they did this year, which is simple concepts and run the ball down your throat. And if it's the Guelph game, it looked super successful. If it's the Mac game, it looked like it was a little too vanilla.
Well, let's not hold the bar of a successful running game to what you did against Guelph the past 2 years, because that's not fair to anybody. You know, I'm glad we got to the run game, though, because I thought at first when you were referring to two guys in playing an impact on this decision, it wasn't going to be about James and Justin graduating out, though that's a great point and how that affects the passing game, but is because of what Anthony Miller and especially this young Quentin Springer were doing in the backfield, running the ball for them. And you add in that piece on just how heavily they committed to this run game, that, you know, knowing Burt's history, trying to bring a bit of that Western mentality in there has me so excited. But I really want to talk about Springer, though, specifically as a rookie, having the performances he did from the Cambridge area, and just what a stellar outing he had and how excited Warriors fans must be for a number of reasons we've touched on, but specifically this kid's potential.
Yeah, I mean, just an awesome rookie season from Springer out of that Jacob Hessler program, which seems to, you know, seems to be in the Offsible series every year. And yeah, it was a really great, I think it was a really great way for him to enter the OUA, right? So Anthony Miller was going to get the bulk of the carries, but he was able to be behind Miller. He was able to be ahead of Tal Ibrahim, who also had actually a pretty solid year. And we saw him break off a big 60 plus yard touchdown run in that last game against Toronto that kind of ended up being the difference. But yeah, Springer, on a raw talent, right? And I know the coaching staff talked lots about kind of the more technical side of having him, you know, getting his shoulder, his pad level lower and being able to hit kind of lower and take a little more physicality, but that's the kind of stuff that's easy to teach. And the explosiveness that he has is kind of the stuff that you have to either have or don't. And he has it. So I think people are super excited to see what he can do next year. You know, just the expectations of everything as a rookie, you guys know, like school and living alone and, you know, a training camp is, you know, it all of a sudden, you know, you're in summer vacation and it's the 10th of August and your summer's over, right? Like all of those things, once you do it once, you know exactly what to expect. And I think Springer's only going to benefit from that. I think he can be, you know, a really high level back that Coach Conway and Coach Burt can rely on as far as a bit of a safety net too. Look, you talked about Burt and his history at Western. If you go even further back in the lineage, like that's Tuffy Knight and like Wishbone stuff, right? Like triple option. Waterloo won a playoff game, you know, the Yates Cup semi of 1999 that Burt was a lineman on. They won that playoff game. Their quarterback went 0-for-4. Like, and they beat Western at Western and they shut down the old stadium. So, I mean,
that's
this is the lineage, right? So if you can run, like, you know, the balance is great. And Burt, we saw Burt, you know, go aerial when he had Trey Ford, but if you can run it, you know, he'll love it. And I think Springer's going to be a huge weapon in that for years to come.
Waterloo with a standard or a above tier run game just always seems to be things are all right in the world. It's death, taxes, and Waterloo has a run game. So it's always something that I think that's going to be a focal point for that, even just naturally kind of going forward. One of the things that I wanted to talk about, especially with you, so many times when we are watching games, there's a lot of things that happen that don't necessarily get caught by stats or whatever else. When you're watching these games here, and I know you mentioned a couple of people like James Hinsberger, are there a couple of players, either offensively, defensively, special teams, or whoever, that you want to highlight that say, these guys are completely under the radar because they may not have the stats or they may not show up on the stat page, but are so important or so impressive to this Waterloo Warrior program?
Yeah, for sure. Like on the offensive side of the ball, honestly, like I think I have to wade into your realm a little bit. Nick Jodaro on the offensive line, he's moved out to tackle. He's started for 2 years now. I think he's going to be a huge piece for the Warriors to be able to, you know, continue to kind of move that running game deeper and deeper entrenched into one of those weapons that, you know, you want those for your run game. I think especially in this league, it's almost one of those situations where you don't even think that you're going to stop it. You just want to try to, you know, like 160 on the ground is actually all right because it could have been 230. And I think Jodaro is definitely a huge part of that. On the defensive side of the ball, there's a safety, Diego Arenas. He was an all-rookie 2 seasons ago. He's out of Quebec. Probably a little smaller than you used to seeing, shorter from a defensive back, but just everywhere. He's fast. He is always downhill towards the ball. You know, in both the run and pass game, he can get down inside really fast. It kind of allows Waterloo to be a little more free with the front seven. And I think he's a huge piece. He always seems to make plays that, again, might not show up on a stat sheet, might not be a breakup. It might not be a, you know, a pick or anything, but really, really solid stuff in the middle of the field that I think is only going to progress. You know, he's only entering his third year too. So I think that's a huge piece on the defensive side for Waterloo.
Adam, last question I want to ask you about is in relation to, obviously we've referenced Battle of Waterloo, and you've kind of given us a little taste of what that experience is like in talking about that call going back to the 2019 affair. So I want to ask somewhat generally about Battle of Waterloo. You've experienced it at a number of levels, including as a student, and just with it being, you know, this battle of, you know, not just the same city, but like literally a snowball's throw away from one another. But even more specifically, in the context of Laurier having this really nice 2-year run, and with this year in particular, Elgersma winning the MVP, them being just as threatening in the league as Western, despite the two losses in those two affairs that they played against them. Anyone who's watched these games know that they are just as good a team we had in the OE way. How is Battle of Waterloo, from your various experiences with it, and how does it feel in a year like this, or as a Warrior fan, wanting to appreciate the majesty that they were doing on the football field twice at your expense, unfortunately, but in having to reconcile those different aspects?
Yeah, it's funny. Like, my first day, by the way, in the city in 2002, I went to, on the Labor Day weekend, I moved into residence and went to a Waterloo Laurier game. Waterloo won like 18-16 on a last second touchdown. That was the last win, by the way, until Trey Ford in 2018 at Laurier beat them.
So it's all your fault.
So yeah, the history goes, I guess. the history goes back a long way. But yeah, like it is. So it's funny. Like I don't get the sense that the teams or the staffs have anything but a ton of respect for each other. And of course we know, you know, head coach Michael Fultz, like, he played on those Western teams that Burt was, you know, was, the offensive line coach and the recruiting coordinator on. Like, there's a, you know, there's a sideline shot from that 2009 Yates that's got, you know, a young Burt with probably a little more on top and a young Michael Fultz limping around and slightly younger Coach Marshall, right? So there's a ton of respect there. I think it definitely does, though. Like, there's definitely in the program a feeling of, like, that's the game we really want, right? And I know the playoff loss specifically left a really bad taste in the mouths of both the players and the staff. Like, I get the feeling that, you know, I don't think anybody expected Waterloo to win that game. But I get the feeling that the way that it happened and to whom it happened is a factor, right? And has really kind of lit a fire, it sounds like, anyway, under folks around the program. Because, yeah, like, the attitude for a long time, it was, you know, we're the bigger school at Waterloo, but they're the bigger football program, you know? And that's a level that I think we at Waterloo want to try to, you know, aspire to. There's a healthy amount of respect, but I think it's definitely a really interesting and a good kind of competitive atmosphere to have a school that's like 1,100 meters down the road that has been in Yates Cups recently and have won Yates Cups recently and has a Vanier banner or two. Like, that's you know, that's something that I think lights the fire a little bit. So really interesting dynamic too, though, with there's so much respect too between the two programs and even the players off the field. Like, I've seen them at Waterloo Laurier hockey games that I'm calling, sitting with each other and, you know, horsing around and joking with each other. These guys all know each other. They've played, you know, they played junior varsity football and high school football and stuff with and against each other for a long time. So really interesting dynamic.
One of the things I wanted to ask you here, once again, leaning on the fact that you are at all the home games, you're watching the games, you're keeping up with things. In your opinion, is there one or two things that you can really nail down in terms of, we finished 3-5, we discussed there's a real potential for at least a 4-4, potentially a 5-3 kind of finish here. What do you think that factor is to just get over that hump for Waterloo in order to win those close games and be in that conversation of, not only are you making the playoffs, but now you're like on the other side of the top three or top four teams in there?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest one, you guys definitely touched on it in your resolutions pod, it's finishing drives. Like, it was, I think the Warriors, I looked it up today, were 11 for 23 in touchdowns in the red zone, and 18 for 23 in scores overall. You know, that was everything, especially because in the passing game, you didn't have a take the top off kind of passing game this year, right? So you look at a team like Western only had 5 more red zone trips than Waterloo did. I think Laurier probably only had 3 or 4 more. They were both in kind of the high 20s, but they also scored 60 yard touchdowns twice a game. And that wasn't happening at Waterloo. So then when you add that to 11 touchdowns on 23 trips inside the red area, that's the biggest thing to me. And the other piece I'll just mention too, and this is something that I know Burt's talked about publicly several times and has been a thing all the way back to the Trey era. It's the start. Like, Waterloo, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but like the first and second quarters, the halftime deficits that Waterloo has overcome over the last 3 or 4 years, it's great to be able to have that experience, but they find themselves behind in games that they probably shouldn't be behind in for any number of reasons, right? And sometimes you just come up short. I'm thinking specifically in the 2019 season, 2018 season, sorry. They had back-to-back games against Guelph, at Guelph, the last game of the regular season in the playoffs, and in both games put themselves behind pretty early. Couldn't find their way back out. They lost in double overtime in the regulation that would have given them a home playoff game, which, by the way, they still haven't had. Like, I've never called a home playoff game at Waterloo. And then they fell. I think they lost by 10 in the playoffs in that first round that Guelph beat them. And again, like, it was down by 17. Now they're down by 10. Now they're down by 7. Now they're down by 14 again. Like, they just couldn't get over the hump. So the starts for sure. And just finishing. And I think a big part of the finishing too will be just the maturity of the quarterback too. Zach, that game that you and I worked, it was 15-0 for Windsor late in the half, and Waterloo was inside the red zone, and Nick Orr had a first down and turned up field and coughed up the football. Right? That game, you do wonder what would happen in Windsor's locker room if that's 15-7 at the half. So those are I think the things that probably stick in the craw of Bert and the staff the most this offseason.
What I think is so great, if I can just use that description in all those problems or those areas of improvement and needing improvement that you highlighted, is that I think so many of them just do connect back, as you said, to that need of maturity. And because you have that youth in there in those key spots, I think it's just another reason why folks that support that program, and a lot of folks who as well, I think, just recognize that, you know, even with the Trey Ford era and as electric as it was, because it wasn't always necessarily wins and losses success, but I think a lot of people still have a soft spot for Waterloo football in their hearts, who, you know, just from what this program has really recovered from. And the comeback piece, it makes me think as well of that game at Guelph, or a game against Guelph a couple years ago, where there was, I think they came back late to beat Guelph. I forget, I think that was 2 years ago, but nonetheless, a very salient point to make. And again, it just all points to that need of a little maturity, which hopefully we'll see this year. Tom, let me get, sorry.
Oh yeah. No, I was just going to say, like, I think the roadmap, you're absolutely right. The roadmap for Nick Orr, like, you know, Waterloo played Taylor Elgisman in his first start. He threw 4 interceptions at home, and he got smoked by 30 points, you know. And there's, I think, the attitude in the Waterloo program is there's no reason that that's not Nick Orr in 2 years, given the tools that he has, right? So if that's, you know, not to take anything away, obviously, from Taylor Augustman, he was outstanding. So if that's even, you know, in the remote ballpark of truth, I think that's a win. And I think some of those issues, like you said, will hopefully kind of solve themselves with maturity.
I love it. Tom, last words to you, my friend.
Very last question I have for you, Mr. McGuire. What is one, at least one aspect, if you want to go into multiple, one aspect of this Waterloo team that you are most excited for going into the 2024 season?
Ooh, that is a good question. You know what? It's probably, for me, it's probably gotta be how the offensive balance can continue to evolve, because I don't frankly see, and we talked about this already, like, the run game has no reason to regress, only progress. But that's the same can be said you know, from an aerial attack point of view too, right? So Nick Orr has all the throws. He's big. He can move around. He can find angles to get the ball out. We've seen, you know, especially at the end of the season, in that Toronto game, like, his connection, I know James Basilik is going to be gone, but, like, he really felt comfortable there in that Toronto game. So I think that's, to me, that's the thing I'm looking forward to the most, is kind of the evolution of the offense. This has always been a team that's kind of taken what they've kind of been given, even in the Trey years. You know, in 2018, Trey had, you know, 2,800 yards passing, And in 2019, Dion Pellerin and him were each in the top four in rushing yards because it was just taking what was a success and what they could move the ball with. So that's what I'm excited for, is the varying ways that Waterloo will be able to move the ball in the fall.
Can't wait, Adam. And as I alluded to earlier, I certainly want to reach out again to connect about some other content me and Tom are thinking of doing, to highlight specifically those of you doing all the hard work up in the booth to make the game that much more enjoyable. And again, thank you so much for inviting me onto your broadcast. So this is the very least us trying to return the favor for that one. Adam, thank you again so much for joining us.
Boys, always a pleasure. Like I said, when we were getting this set up, I'm no Mad Jack Moore as far as my intel and insight, but always pumped to talk Warriors football.
Hey, long snappers are people too. So if you're keeping track at home, that's a wrap for the Waterloo Pod, which means we have Carlton up next for the other side of that 31-30 comeback to get their side of the story. So we'll talk to you then right here at the 55.